Bonjour et bienvenue à la balado-diffusion du colloque « Éthique des médias, de l'information au marché » tenu à Montréal en avril 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast of the Media Ethics from Information to Markets Conference that took place in Montreal in April 2009.
Alors, dans un premier temps, Darren Barney is an assistant professor at the Department of Art History and Communication Studies at McGill University. He also holds the Canada Research Chair in Technology and Citizenship. He is the author of Communication Technology, the Canadian Democratic Audit, published in 2005, The Network Society, published in Policy Press, 2004, and Prometheus Wired, The Hope for Democracy in the Age of Network Technology, published in 2000, which was awarded the 2001 Award for Social and Ethical Relevance in Communication Research by the McGannon Center for Communication Research at Fordham University. Ensuite, nous aurons le plaisir d'écouter Raymond Corriveau, qui est actuellement président du Conseil de presse du Québec. Il est aussi professeur titulaire au département des lettres et communications à l'Université du Québec à Trois-Rivières depuis 1989. Ses principaux champs d'intérêt portent sur la communication et les situations d'exception, par exemple prévention de maladies vectorielles et situations d'urgence. Il est l'auteur de « Pour redécouvrir le monde rural », publié en 1993, « Le plan de communication, une approche pour agir en société », publié en 2004. Il est aussi co-auteur ou collaborateur de « Les réseaux de support communautaire », publié en 1994, « Communication en temps de crise », 1999, et « Mesures individuelles et collectives pour prévenir la transmission du virus du Nil occidental », élément pour un plan global d'intervention, publié en 2005. Il est membre du conseil d'administration de l'Association canadienne de communication et organisateur responsable de la section francophone et organisateur responsable de la section communication pour l'ACFAS. Et en dernier lieu, nous aurons l'occasion d'entendre Chris McDonald. He is an associate professor in the philosophy department at St. Mary's University, Halifax. He is doing research in business and professional ethics and healthcare ethics, currently focusing on ethical issues in the biotechnology and nanotechnology industries and foundational issues in moral theory as well. Last fall, he was a visiting fellow at the Cannon Institute for Ethics at Duke University. He is currently a visiting professor at the Keck Graduate Institute of Applied Life Sciences in Claremont, California. He also writes a very popular blog on business ethics, who was also incidentally voted among the most influential in North America. Alors sur ce, donc je vous rappelle un peu les consignes. Chaque présentateur dispose de 25 minutes pour sa communication. Chaque conférence sera suivie d'une période de questions d'une quinzaine de minutes et nous prendrons une pause à la suite des deux premiers conférenciers et juste avant d'entendre Chris McDonald. Sans plus tarder, donc, je cède la parole à Darren Barney qui nous présentera une présentation intitulée « The Revenge of Publicity ».
OK, thank you. What I want to talk about today is a small part of a larger problem that I've been thinking about over the past several months, and that's the problem that technology poses for politics. By politics, I mean two things. First, the exposure of relationships of power and inequality, and second, engagement with others in making judgments about what is good and just and acting on those judgments. More specifically, I'm interested in the phenomenon of depoliticization, and that names the dynamic or phenomenon in which relationships of power and inequality are obscured or concealed rather than revealed, and by which questions of what is good and just to do are removed from rather than subject to political judgment and action. The problem that technology, and here I'm thinking about technology broadly, encompassing both a variety of particular devices and systems as well as the culture of technological societies more generally. The problem that technology poses for politics is that while technology is itself irreducibly political, Under the conditions of modern liberal capitalist societies, it tends, I think, in the direction of depoliticization. Technology is political because it emerges from political circumstances, okay, in which a variety of actors and discourses and institutions with a variety of interests are differentially situated. And it's also political because it has political outcomes in which power and resources are distributed differentially, in which identities and relationships are established or undermined, and in which permissions and prohibitions are materialized. So technology is political in all those ways, but it can and often does tend to be depoliticizing because it obscures the political character of its own origins and its outcomes. And it's often used to do the same in relation to other non-technological phenomena and issues, such as, for example, when perceived technological imperatives are invoked to insulate particular economic decisions or arrangements from political contest or scrutiny. In these cases, despite its necessarily political character, technology often, not always, but often operates to close down rather than to open up the space for political judgment and action concerning technology itself, as well as concerning a broad range of other social and economic questions. So it's this contradictory character of technology in relation to politics that I'm interested in, at once necessarily political, but also with a strong tendency towards depoliticization. And in trying to think through this contradiction, I've been also trying to think about the conditions of possibility for politics in order to investigate how technology as a means or a potential means of doing politics, as a site upon which politics is enacted and as a kind of cultural setting in which politics either does or doesn't take place, bears on these conditions. What are the conditions of politics that technology bears on? Now, without going into all the theoretical argumentation around each of these, I'll just say very briefly that I would say that and of course this is a potentially longer list and people have different lists, but I would say that the conditions of possibility for political judgment and action are as follows: contingency, difference, publicity, friendship, antagonism, and courage. Now, as you'll appreciate, each of these is freighted with a great deal of complexity, and my purpose today is not at all to lay out in detail my arguments for what those conditions entail or why I see them as necessary conditions of politics. What I really want to do today is focus on just one of these conditions, and that is the condition of publicity, or what we might call publicness in a slightly more clumsy formulation. Publicness, the condition of participating with others in communication in the public sphere. And I want to make a few observations concerning the present status of publicity. I want to explore what becomes of publicity under contemporary technological circumstances, particularly those circumstances established by emerging media technologies. My argument is that under the conditions established by emerging media technologies, publicity has a tendency to convert from a regime or principle of politicization into a regime or principle of depoliticization. And as such, the normative framework of publicity, okay, this normative framework which turns on expectations concerning the democratic value of access to information, communication, and participation, okay, this normative framework is seriously compromised as a critical framework under contemporary technological conditions. In the contemporary context, there's a tendency for information, communication, and participation to stand in for things like motivation, judgment, and action, respectively, I would say. And the affordances of media, of emerging media technologies, incline us to settle for publicity in the place of more demanding political practices and goods. We're still, I think, under contemporary political economic conditions, the normalization of expansive access to information, communication, and participation may actually bolster rather than challenge existing regimes of depoliticization and inequality. And in such circumstances, we reach the point where publicity begins to undermine itself. This is the possibility that has been explored by the American political theorist Jody Dean in her 2002 book, Publicity's Secret. In that book, she argues that the norms of publicity have come to stand in for political ends that we might otherwise think that they are intended to serve, ends such as material and political equality and social and economic justice. In a cultural context where we've come to accept the idea that knowledge is power, we're well prepared to believe that access to information and communication are central to the realization of democratic political goals. And we're encouraged in this belief by an explosion of emerging technologies that mediate diverse modes, not just of gathering information, but also participating and collaborating in its generation and its circulation in an equally diverse range of communicative practices and settings. This is precisely the situation that emerging media present to us. The apparent materialization of the promise of publicity through an unprecedented expansion of the reach of participatory, collaborative information and communication practices. But it's, I think, far from clear that information is motivation, that communication is judgment, or that to participate is to act. In his book, The Parallax View, Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek said this. He said, the threat today is not passivity, but pseudo-activity, the urge to be active, to participate, to mask the nothingness of what goes on. The truly difficult thing is to stay back, to withdraw from all of this. Those in power often prefer even a critical participation, a dialogue, to silence. Now, in characteristically provocative fashion, Žižek here draws attention to the fact that in liberal democracies, political action by citizens is often limited to participation in established institutions and processes that embody and secure and stabilize existing distributions of power and resources, rather than opening these to political judgment and contest. And in this context, participation is nothing like what it's imagined to be in the work of theorists of participatory democracy, namely a practice where citizens exercise their equality and their autonomy vis-a-vis political and economic authority. Instead, in this view, participation becomes the form of compliance with and legitimation of undemocratic forms of authority and discipline. And under such conditions, mere participation and its constituents, information and communication, converts to a principle of depoliticization, the very opposite of political action. Now, this possibility arises at the very moment that emerging media technologies are sponsoring a massive expansion and generalization of participatory culture. In the emerging media environment, an ever-blossoming range of applications present countless opportunities to vote, to rank, to comment, to mash up, produce, present, mark up, post, tag, choose, share, customize, network, link, navigate, discuss, play, feedback, collaborate, okay, via an equally diverse array of devices. Okay. Such opportunities are not restricted to the online world. Conventional media, including especially television, increasingly integrate opportunities for participation by broadcast audiences into their programming. Traditional cultural sites such as museums and galleries have enthusiastically embraced technologies aimed at enhancing the participatory experience of their visitors. Emerging technologies of spatial augmented reality are transforming urban space into a matrix of opportunities for network-mediated information transaction, commercial and otherwise. Even governments, imagine, have started to capitalize on digital networks to enable citizen participation in policy consultation. Now, the name customarily given to these participatory opportunities is interactivity, a term that's nearly replaced participation itself in the normative vocabulary of contemporary publicity. To describe interactivity as the availability of opportunities to participate, I think is somewhat misleading. As the British scholar Andrew Berry has argued in his work on the migration of participatory features into science museums, interactivity has become an important mode by which emerging technologies have been brought to bear in the production of subjects adapted to the demands of citizenship in post-Fordist political economies. Under these conditions, interactivity is compulsory, not optional. Okay? He writes, active, responsible, and informed citizens have to be made. Today, interactivity has come to be a dominant model of how objects can be used to produce subjects. In an interactive model, subjects are not disciplined, they are allowed. Okay. The ideal subject of advanced liberal capitalism is informed, is flexible, is empowered, is experimental, is self-inventing, and self-responsible. The subject of contemporary liberal modernity does not so much participate democratically in government as she does govern herself by participation. Seen in this context, Andrew Berry writes, interactive devices have a function, for they foster agency, experimentation, and enterprise, thus enhancing the self-governing capacities of the citizen. And he says, in this respect, interactivity is a model for the exercise of political power. Okay? A model in which the distribution and exercise of power is authorized and legitimated not by political judgment and action, but rather by an excess of participatory activity that provides an alibi for the effective absence of opportunities for judgment and action. And when it degenerates into interactivity, the normative framework of publicity, I think, begins to strain under the weight of emerging technologies of information, communication, and participation. Okay. As I mentioned before, the implications of this collapse have been explored very thoroughly by Jody Dean, and I'm going to stand on her shoulders for a little while in what follows. For Dean, the political significance of emerging media can't be understood apart from their role in materializing communicative capitalism, that massive portion of the transnational economy that relies heavily on the transaction of information and communication commodities via an array of network technologies. Communicative capitalism is a political economic formation in which, as we heard this morning, power, financial wealth, and material security are intensely concentrated, and in which depoliticization has emerged as a kind of chronic condition. Dean's provocative insight is that despite its democratic shortcomings, communicative capitalism is actually bolstered, not threatened, by the normative framework of publicity. Okay? Under the auspices of this economic arrangement, emerging technologies are assigned fantastic, magical qualities vis-a-vis the political. The fantasy of information abundance, for example, condenses a broad and complex range of political antagonisms into a straightforward problem of information. As she writes, the complexities of politics, of organization, struggle, duration, decisiveness, division, representation, etc., are condensed into one thing, one problem to be solved, and one technological solution. So the problem of democracy is that people aren't informed. They don't have the information they need to participate effectively, end quote. People may need information in order to act, and I think they do, and producing and circulating information may be one way to act politically, but constructing the problem of politics as primarily a problem of inadequate access to information opens it to a technological solution that can easily and profitably be achieved in ways that leave major structures of inequality and depoliticization not only intact, but even reinforced. Closely related is what Dean calls the fantasy of participation, and here she cites Zizek's account of interpassivity. She describes a condition in which technologically enabled interactivity gratifies popular appetites for judgment and action without actually satisfying them politically. As she says of the myriad ways that we daily add to the circulation of information in digital networks, one believes that it matters, that it contributes, that it means something. They believe that they're active, maybe even that they're making a difference by clicking on a button, adding their name to a petition, or commenting in a blog. But the political status of these forms of participation is ambiguous at best. As many new social movements have demonstrated, Okay? Emerging technologies can absolutely be mobilized effectively in political struggles. But it would take a considerable leap of faith, I think, to believe that this sort of robust politicization is characteristic of the experience of most of those who interact and contribute online. For most of us, online participation stands in relation to the demands of politics as a convenient technique of foreclosure. The myriad opportunities for interaction afforded by communicative capitalism are culturally coded in advance as political, and thus eliminate any motivation or even any obligation to take on heavier burdens of judgment and action. And in these circumstances, the prospects of politics suffer, not because people lack an appetite for politics, but rather because this appetite is too easily gratified by a range of technological surrogates. As Dean observes, the circulation of communication is depoliticizing, not because people don't care or don't want to be involved, but because we do. The complementarity of communicative capitalism and the framework of publicity thus sets a trap, I think, for those committed to radical politicization and egalitarianism. The normative framework of publicity valorizes access to information, communication, and participation. Communicative capitalism is nourished and sustained by the transaction of information, communication, and interactive participation. Norms of publicity are materialized in emerging media technologies that are instrumental to the extension and intensification of a political economic order whose relationship to democratic outcomes is at best ambiguous. Okay. It's not just that informing, communicating, and participating in the forms that are typically afforded by emerging media technologies are inadequate relative to the demanding conceptions, or relative to demanding conceptions of the political, or that they can be enlisted to ends that are other than democratic. It's not just that. It's that the principles of publicity themselves, participation, information, and communication, offer us no way to distinguish genuinely democratic politics from enrollment in the prevailing rhythms and modes of a global economy structured in opposition to the ends of those politics. In this sense, publicity has become, as Dean puts it, the ideology of technoculture, a model of political life that would work just as well as a motto for Microsoft or AT&T. The ideals of publicity have conditioned us to desire and expect exactly what emerging information and communication technologies deliver. More information, more communication, more participation. Who could ask for anything more? Cruelly, I think, even the practices of deeply politicized social movements in making highly effective use of these emerging technologies for the purposes of publicization, mobilization, organization, implicitly, in a way, confirm the edifice that they explicitly challenge. As Dean puts it, in effect, changing the system, organizing against and challenging communicative capitalism seems to require strengthening the system. Democracy demands publicity. When information, communication, and participation substitute for motivation, political judgment, and action, the normative framework of publicity ceases to be critical and becomes conservative in the most straightforward sense of that term. And this, I think, is what becomes of publicity under the material conditions of emerging media technologies. Under the combination of proliferating networks and advanced liberal capitalism, Dean says, our deepest commitments to inclusion, to equality, to participation within a public bind us to practices whereby we submit to global capital. The ideal of the informed, communicating, participating citizen may have had radical potential under conditions where opportunities to be informed, to communicate, and to participate were scarce or denied. But thanks to emerging media technologies, these conditions no longer pertain, at least not in liberal democracies. Instead, the common experience of liberal democratic citizens is one of an excess of such opportunities. And despite what I would argue is its depoliticizing character, it's upon this very excess that the legitimacy of contemporary technological capitalism has been built. For Dean, this means that it's time to acknowledge that the public is an ideal whose materialization undermines its very aspirations. She concludes, for the sake of democracy, It's time to abandon the public. Now, what might abandoning the public mean? Okay, I want to conclude with this. It doesn't mean that we should try to imagine a politics that could or should unfold without information, without communication, without participation, or that the absence of access to information, communication, and participation is somehow a good thing. Okay? And it doesn't mean that we should dismiss the actions of people and movements who engage in practices of information, communication, and participation in highly politicized ways, or the actions of those who struggle against the privatization and enclosure of the means of information, communication, and participation. Nor does it mean that we should prejudicially dismiss the utility that emerging media technologies bring to these genuinely political struggles. What it means, I think, is that under the material and cultural conditions bolstered by these technologies, in the context of contemporary capitalism, we must be very wary of converting access to information, communication, and participation into ends in themselves, rather than means to ends beyond themselves, okay? The end of politics. Under the conditions materialized by emerging media, the conversion of information, communication, and participation into ends in themselves is a formula for depoliticization. Right? It's the expression of publicity enacting revenge upon itself. Right? And since there can really be no reasonable sense can there be a question of being opposed to information, communication, and participation. Imagine someone saying such a thing. I'm opposed to information. I'm opposed to communication. I'm opposed to participation. There can be no question of such an opposition. And there can be no question of emerging media technology suddenly disappearing, turning all the devices off, shutting down and ripping up all the networks. That's an equally unreasonable proposition. Okay? So because there's no question of being opposed to those goods, and there's no question of shutting down the networks or being opposed to these technologies, the only question that might save publicity from itself, I think, is the question of what, after all, it is for, if not simply for itself. Okay? And I think the simple act of raising this question will probably prevent those who ask it for settling for publicity in the place of politics. I'll stop there.
Thanks, Darren. I'm glad that you delayed your presentation for long enough that I was able to hear it. That was very provocative. So a test, I guess, would it be a test of the plausibility of the strong thesis? So there's a kind of a weak claim and a strong claim that can be extracted from the paper, and I take it that you're very much in favor of the strong claim. The weak claim is, look, it's not enough to have communication, participation, publicity. We also have to have participation. The stronger claim is that the way in which these three have been sort of institutionalized today actually makes it less likely that we'll get politicization, right? So I guess a test of that stronger thesis would be, what was it like before? You know, there's an implicit kind of nostalgic argument there. You know, things were better when we didn't have the internet, right? And it's you know, I mean, thinking about it off the top of my head, but it's not like, say, 35 years ago, right, whenever, you know, really we were well clear of the internet. It's not like we had, you know, all these people politicized, and it seems to me that they're parallel tracks. The depoliticization of our societies, to the extent that they are depoliticized, and the sort of emergence of new ways in which to communicate, publicize, and act, seem to me to be, you know, unless I'm not seeing something, unless, you know, it is the case that you know, this, I don't know, there was stuff going on in the 70s the 80s, yeah, that would empirically sort of...
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good intervention. You may sense, and I mean, I'm trying to see in which passages that sense arises, and I kind of, like you said, an implicit nostalgia. But I do try to be careful about not phrasing the argument in terms of there was a golden age when everyone was politicized and along came emerging media technology that sucked the politics out of everyone. I don't think that's the case at all. I do think I would put it slightly differently, though. I would say that, you know, there have always been techniques and instruments, whether technological or cultural, of depoliticization, right? And almost every time an emerging media technology has arrived, there is a kind of social struggle over whether that technology will be a technology of politicization or depoliticization. I think that in the context of contemporary culture in North America, certainly, but elsewhere, there has been a tendency to kind of valorize, exaggerate, celebrate the potential of these as politicizing technologies. I think I try to acknowledge that in the talk and say, look, obviously, there are political actors who use these technologies in those ways. There are political actors who weren't politicized before but are now because of the affordances of these media. No question about it. But I think what there needs to be is a kind of balancing corrective that says, all right, but we need to simultaneously think about not just what I would call the real nostalgic arguments of, oh, you know, wasn't it great when we used to sit around and all talk about the same article that was in the New York Times instead of being
in coffee houses.
Right, I don't make any of those arguments. What I try to say is instead, what we need to be is very aware of, vigilant of, the ways in which these same technologies, as a site of struggle, are being deployed in depoliticizing ways and are being taken up in depoliticizing ways, and how we participate in generating kind of discourses that obscure that parallel depoliticizing dynamic from our awareness and our consciousness. That's about how I would think.
Darren, my name is Arthur Applebaum. Daniel actually asked a part of my question, so I could be briefer. I'm a philosopher, so I have a very, very high tolerance for abstraction. Uh-huh. And it would be completely unfair to ask you to give evidence for your view. I mean, that's not the business you're in. But an example, perhaps, you know, an anecdote. I'll give you a counter-anecdote. I come from your, until very recently, benighted neighbor in the South. We just had what I think is a transformative election. The transformative election was brought about in part by precisely the technologies, in part, precisely by the technologies that you say are essentially a mask for shilling for depoliticization. Now, you can go in two ways. You could say, you could deny it. You could actually say, well, no, I've fallen into your trap. The election of Barack Obama is not actually so transformative. That's one move you can make. But I actually think what happened in the United States in its connection to technology actually is a counterexample. So do you have any anecdotal examples that might support what in the end is a very elaborate but abstract empirical claim?
Yeah, I mean, I think one, and I mean, you might see these as various wiggles, but I mean, I think one thing is that we can't rely on anecdotal examples, right? Now, that's a different question. You know, so asking me about empirical, right, is a different question than asking me about anecdotes. I think, and again, I wouldn't be prepared to say you're wrong about the transformative character of what happened in the last election in the United States either, but I think it's way, way too early while we're still in the haze of celebrating the fact that this man actually was elected president of the United States to proclaim yet again that there's been a transformation of the American political culture and the American political polity, as the claim was made about the Dean campaign, and that claim has been made over and over again about these technologies. Now everyone says, no, but it's really happened this time. It's fundamentally different this time. It may be, but I think to make that claim, I think we precisely need not anecdotes, we need research that is going to emerge now, that's going to be forensic, that's going to have the benefit of time, and that's going to look at what happened to the people whose mobilization was supposedly mediated by these technologies in support of Obama's campaign, to what extent these technologies were instrumental or incidental to that mobilization, and what the robustness of that mobilization has been. I think, for example, just to talk empirically, like I've been watching Obama very carefully, as everybody has, especially people who are inclined to be strong supporters of what he achieved and is trying to achieve and what he represents in the American polity. But I also think we have to be very careful about giving Obama a pass in various ways. And for me, as a person who's interested in the politics of technology, I'm specifically focusing on those questions. So I look at, for example, the much lauded town hall that he had recently, that that solicited questions from online, 90,000 people logged in with questions, and they were filtered, and he addressed those questions. And I think that if you take Obama out of that equation, and if you put in a politician whose politics we don't agree with so much, we would have a very different appraisal of that event. We would look very critically at the kind of character of the structure of the way that that event was organized. If he was really trying to democratize things through this technology, why did he just stand there and answer questions in the normal mode that politicians do instead of saying, well, you tell me what you think. Why don't we sit down? You know what I mean? Like, there's all kinds of deliberative democracy theorists would have a field day with that format, right? But we kind of tend to think it's something interesting because it was Obama. We also, in relation to that specific event, in other circumstances we would see that as a kind of crassly populist move to get around established institutions of government in the United States. We like it because our politics are with him, and we think that there's a problem in those institutions that preventing progressive reform. But on the other hand, there's a long history of right-wing politicians using plebiscitory instruments and technologies to get around delegated forms of judgment and institutions in order to appeal to the people directly to bring about change. I hope he achieves it because I'm into the ends that he's into, but I think as analysts we have to be very careful about how we assess this set of events in relation to provocative theses like the one I'm exploring here.
Hey, Darren. I want to follow up the same sort of general path because I think... a concern I would raise about this thesis, it was funny, while you're going through, I was thinking, where have I heard versions of this before? Oh yeah, it's Neil Postman talking about television, or Noam Chomsky talking about New York Times, or Heidegger talking about all technology in general, right? Technology hides the political nature of its own operation. Okay, fine. And then I was thinking, well, if TV is the realm of image, and newspapers are the realm of manufacturing consent, and now the internet is the realm of communicative capitalism. What are we left with, right? And when you got to the end and you used the phrase, we need to abandon the public, I was like, well, of course, right? That's obviously the case, because participatory democracy is impossible in a mass society on the terms you're setting for it. Hmm. And I guess what my concern is, this actually runs a very serious danger of fueling the forces of reaction.
Could.
To the extent to which, a good analogy I would say is, you're probably familiar with the 60s movement where the students, the SDS, gradually became increasingly radicalized into the weather, underground, and so on, to the point where there was a vanguard of about six of them whose slogan was, pardon the expression, everyone, but fuck the people.
Yeah.
And when the people become your enemy in the search for democracy, you're running a very serious danger of fueling reaction.
Yeah, I would say two things. First of all, I wouldn't. That was a quote from Jody Dean. We have to abandon the public. I would phrase it differently. I would say, in the context of my analysis, we have to reconsider the normative framework of publicity as a critical framework in relation to the possibility of politics. And I wouldn't say we have to. I would consider my argument to be a kind of in favor of the people's possibility of engaging in real politics, as opposed to a kind of their kind of packaging up as the commodity of the public, which so often happens in contemporary mediated contexts. I would also say this in response to your question, which is an excellent one, about the ambivalent potential for an argument like this vis-a-vis the kind of politics that can be mobilized in favor of, right? I think, and this is part of some of the broader thinking that I've been doing about what is the nature of politics today, like what is it that that's actually at stake there. I think that all kind of genuinely political moments are very risky moments, right? I think they're very risky moments in that they can go any number of ways, not just in the direction of reaction or progress, but there's actually a kind of multiple complex set of directionalities that can come out of any legitimately political moment. And recognizing that, I think, forces us to ask ourselves the question whether we want politics or not, right? It's risky, right? If you're a person who thinks that generally things are organized in a way that is to the systemic and chronic disadvantage of certain elements of the population and that institutions have accrued in a way that kind of stabilizes that situation, then you're probably willing to take the risk of politics. But if you think that, by and large, we're even those disadvantaged people are probably better off now under the situation that we have with a little bit of modification and reform, then you're probably, in your heart of hearts, not interested in politics, at least not in the way that I've discussed it as this kind of radical moment of contingency. You're probably more into something like responsible stewardship of this massive enterprise that we're involved in. My own politics lead me to favor politics at this moment, despite the risks of it. That's all.
Yes, I was wondering if you've fallen into the trap of technological determinism. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what you could say about another manner to say whatever you want to say about technological process, political process, social process. Yeah. Don't each process mingle with another one? Mm-hmm. So what can you say about this technological determinism that you seem to...
Yeah. I mean, I think it probably sounds a bit like technological term. This is a technological determinism. Like, for someone in my field, that's like the dirtiest thing you can call anyone, right, is a technological determinism. So it's not the first time I've been called that. But I think that the reason it sounds like that is because, in fact, what I did was making an argument for a strong tendency in a contemporary set of technological practices and discourses. And it makes it sound like what I'm saying is the technology itself is making it that way, and it can be no other way. That's certainly not the position that I hold. I mean, I did in the talk even try to talk about how there are actors who mobilize these technologies and these systems in resolutely political ways that are outside the framework that I was characterizing here as the kind of dominant and mainstream framework. In the work more broadly, I talk about technology almost precisely in the way that you describe it there, saying that we kind of have to disaggregate the ways in which technology bears on politics as a means of doing politics or doing anti-politics, as a site on which political struggles get waged or don't get waged, and as a kind of cultural setting in which practices of citizenship more broadly get meaning and language gets meaning. And in all of those domains, those are all domains of social struggle. Those are all domains of contest. Those are all domains of contingency. Things could go one way or another. Now, institutional decks are stacked, linguistic decks are stacked, discourses are established, but nevertheless, you have to at least believe that there's contingency in any encounter with technology. Otherwise, all you're saying is we're doomed. And that's, you know, the spirit of this critique, which is a kind of strident critique, is precisely to open up political space, because I believe that to the extent that political space gets closed in technological settings, it's a social closure, it's not a technical necessity.
Bonjour, une question en français. Dans une vie antérieure, il m'est arrivé d'être à la fois mécluanien et foucaldien. Donc je comprends tout à fait les ruses infinies du pouvoir de l'économie politique. Je comprends également les possibles conditionnements formels résultant de la structure même du médium. D'où les deux parties de ma brève question. Est-ce que dans votre modèle, il y a quand même une différenciation formelle des médiums entre eux? Je veux dire, la télévision n'est pas l'Internet, et donc il est possible que, du point de vue des possibilités de participation qui sont permises par la structure même du média, qu'il y ait des différences. Ça, c'est la première partie, disons, la partie mécluanienne de ma question. La partie, disons, plus foucaldienne, baudrillardienne, est-ce qu'il y a quand même d'autres formes de résistance que s'abstenir? Je veux dire, il y a dans le... Enfin, c'est vrai, c'est une vie antérieure, donc je ne me rappelle pas exactement, mais il y a des formes de résistance qui résultent de la pratique même du médium. Je parle du détournement des ruses du pouvoir. On n'a qu'à penser ce qui s'est passé assez récemment en République de Moldavie, où on a créé des espaces publics alternatifs, justement à travers les médias alternatifs, alors que la télévision et la radio transmettaient de la musique, alors que dans la rue, il y avait une révolution. Donc, s'il y a une différenciation des médias entre eux, du point de vue des conditionnements formels, et s'il n'y a quand même pas d'autres formes de résistance. Merci.
I think there are meaningful distinctions between television and the Internet in relation to the thesis that I was discussing here, in that it's precisely the kind of technical affordances of interactivity that are provided by the emerging media that simultaneously open the space of politics relative to broadcast media, but also are, at least according to the argument I made today, recuperated in this discourse of publicity that then sort of confirms that things are moving in democratic directions because we have all these technical affordances for participation and choice making, and that whole list of things, markup, tag, all that kind of thing. And I think those are affordances that are fairly, at least not, if not specific, then at least brought to the fore by emerging media. But of course, they have a what we could call an ambivalent or a kind of contradictory or dialectic manifestation, in that they are at once the source of our hope for the political possibilities in this medium, but also are the very kind of technical attributes that then get recuperated and folded back into a kind of revenge of publicity scenario that I discussed here. So I think those are meaningful differences. But I don't think those differences automatically result in emerging media being more democratic than television, right? Okay. Second question about other sites of resistance, right, besides what is conceived of under publicity. Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, I mean, I think that there are other sites of resistance. First of all, I think that a lot of resistance goes on online and mediated by online technologies. So I think that's important to specify. But I also think that some of the most interesting kinds of resistance are arising in contexts where people are not necessarily participating in the political opportunities that are presented to them in this framework, but instead are going about the political business of enacting different ways of living, alternative economies, marginal economies, right? For example, just a quick example that'll sound strange, but in one of my other research projects, I'm investigating the politics of the transformation of grain handling technology in the Canadian prairies. And I'm following a group of farmers in Alberta who are struggling very hard, as if it was 1920 again, to establish a small-scale local cooperative alternative for grain handling to an alternative to the concentrated agribusiness grain companies that now dominate grain handling on the Canadian prairies, much to the detriment of small-scale farming. There's complex politics in all of that, but I raise that as an example because that they are far more political than a range of people that I encounter all the time who say they're political because they participate in political parties, for example, or established forms of political practice. And it's because they are doing the hard political work of building a different community, basically. Making judgments, acting, risk-taking risks, putting things on the line. And I think that is a source, that kind of example is a source of resistance that's encouraging to me, I would say.
Thank you very much, Darren.